innovation is something that's a constant process. It's something that should actually be embedded into the whole culture of the organization rather than being in the hands of a few specialists. When you embed it into the organization, then you've got constant improvement, constantly getting better. You're not just trying to innovate for the big things, which is what innovation departments try to do. They try to get that we'll be the next Uber of banking or whatever. No, when you've got that within your organization as an attitude that we are coming up with ideas to make things better, you're constantly improving everything. And the whole company is moving forward with momentum. And that's how you properly do innovation. It's not these radical leaps to try to be disruptive. That's the stuff that I think is responsible for only 6% of CEOs being satisfied with their company's innovation. 6%. So that means that 94% of company CEOs are not satisfied with their company's innovation. Even when the same study showed that 84% of CEOs believe that it's really important to the future of their business. It's screwed up. Something's gone badly wrong.
So you're a smart business committed to innovation, to service, and to modern marketing. And you're asking, what's next? Wondering how you can become even more innovative. My name is Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and this is the InnovaBuzz podcast, where we share all kinds of tips, advice, and interview guests on all things innovation and leadership in modern marketing. Hi, innovators. It's great to be back with another episode. I hope you've had an awesome week so far. I'm really excited today to have on the InnovaBuzz podcast as my guest, Dave Burris, who's an author, a speaker, and a consultant on all things creativity and innovation. In fact, Dave's obsessed with creativity, with what it is, with where it comes from, and its role in our history and place in our future. And of course, what makes some people more creative than others. He's on a mission to enable people to harness their untapped creative abilities. In his new book, about to be released, How to Get Great Ideas, he proposes a new theory of creativity. In that book, Dave explores what makes some individuals more creatively productive, and he shows how businesses can encourage creative thinking in their workplace. Today's episode is brought to you by the Transformational Marketing Hub, where you'll find a host of free and exceptionally useful information to help you transform your marketing. You can access the Transformational Marketing Hub by visiting innovabiz.co/VIP. If you don't already have an account, just click the blue Take a Peek Inside button. As I said, it's free and exceptionally useful, and especially for you, my podcast audience. In our discussion today, Dave talked to me about creativity and innovation in organisations and how to foster an innovative culture in those organisations. He talked about the process of creativity and of generating new ideas. And we talked about why it's important to play. Without further ado then, let's fly into the hive and get the buzz from Dave Burris. Hi, I'm your host, Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm really excited to welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast today, all the way from London in the UK, Dave Burris, who's an author, a speaker, and a consultant on all things creativity and innovation. In fact, Dave's obsessed with creativity, what it is, where it comes from, its role in history, its place in our future, and what makes some people more creative than others. He's on a mission to enable people to harness their untapped creativity. So welcome to the podcast, Dave. It's a privilege to have you as a guest.
Thank you, Jürgen. So good to be here. And hello, listener. Welcome. Join us. Yeah.
And Sun Yu, your co-author of the book Iconic Advantage, which you wrote with him, he was our guest on episode 142 of the InnovaBuzz podcast. He suggested we interview you and introduced us. So a big hello to Sun.
Hi, Sun. Sun is a very, very fine man. Working together. Oh, yeah. We've become very good friends. He's wonderful. Yeah.
And I really enjoyed the interview with him that is actually, as we speak, is publishing, I think, tomorrow. So, but it will be public by the time this goes to air. Yes. Now, your new book is about to be released in just over a week's time, we were talking before, and it's called How to Get Great Ideas. It proposes a new theory of creativity. and you explore what makes some individuals more creatively productive. And you also look at how businesses can encourage creative thinking in the workplace, which is another area that I'm really fascinated by, and I'm really keen to unpack that some more with you today. But before we start talking about all things innovation, creativity and ideas, let's find out a bit more about you as a person. What did you want to do when you grew up as a young child?
You know, I'm Scottish, and growing up in Scotland, I'd be told stories of how my country people had invented the world. You know, it's Scots that invented steam engines. We invented stereotypes for printing, which totally revolutionized the printing process. We invented logarithms. We invented microwaves. Or did we? No, we didn't invent microwaves. We invented refrigerators and we invented toasters. We invented penicillin. You know, a tarmac for roads. It's all so many things. Television, fax machines. So many things came out of Scotland. And hearing these stories of great inventors growing up as a child, I wanted a bit of that, that innovation thing about me. I wanted to be able to make a little dent in history, to be a footnote in an encyclopedia someplace. And it kind of got me interested in anything to do with ideas. And from that, I sort of went on a bit of a journey. So I got interested in creative things. When I left university, I became a session musician and a recording engineer. And that kind of led me into, would you believe it, being a stand-up comedian. I then did all sorts of stuff on top of that, and then fell into the world of advertising. And I spent 20 years in advertising and became creative director of a bunch of big agencies in London. And then in 2010, I left that behind. And since then, I've been training people, writing books, speaking. I'm a filmmaker, so I directed, wrote and presented a six-part TV series in the UK a few years ago that was about how different industries have been shaken up by innovations within them and what they're doing to cope. So I kind of now I'm all about, I'm an author, I'm a consultant, I'm a broadcaster, and what else am I? I don't know. I just a chap, just generally a chap.
Yeah, well, it sounds like you've had a hand in so many things, and I'm fascinated how you transitioned from being a stand-up comedian into the advertising industry and then used all the experiences you had to look at how ideas come about and the impact of ideas and changes in those industries.
Yeah, well the transition from stand-up comedian to advertising was from a total misunderstanding. I thought that advertising was being a sit-down comedian. And I thought that was easier, and here it's not. It's actually you have to sell stuff.
All right, so you've shared with us a little bit of what you do today, and I guess the why is encapsulated in the book, because I think you described it somewhere in the book as a practical guide on how people and organizations can have better ideas, which seems to me to be the mission of the book itself.
Yeah. I mean, it's my mission. It's the mission of the book, and that part of the book, it came around because I was in the phone to Sun, and Sun is brilliant at challenging me, and he was just saying, Dave, what is it about? In a nutshell, what's it about? And I explained to him, and he said, no, not simple enough. What's it about? And I've kind of, and I started bumbling. He said, you need to work on this. And I went away. I went away immediately and sort of spent a couple of hours actually trying to hone it down to exactly what this is about. And yeah, a lot of it is really just helping people and organizations get to more effective ideas, I guess, is what everything that I do is about.
One of the things I particularly love about the book is that every chapter has some practical homework that is designed to, as you put it, exercise your creative muscle. And you start off in the book talking about 10 sort of common myths about creativity. And I think the first whole section of the book is about debunking those myths. And one of them is that, you know, some people are creative and others are not. And so talk to us a little bit about that, because I think your contention is that we're all creative. It's just some of us have kind of ignored the muscle a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I come from an industry, I guess the advertising industry, I would naturally say was kind of my home industry because I spent so long in it. And, you know, in the world of advertising, there is this myth that some people are creative and others aren't. You know, you've got a creative department. They're the only ones really that are supposed to be able to come up with ideas. Mm. And to me, it's a really harmful assumption to make because ideas come from knowledge, experience, this breadth of knowledge, breadth of experience. The more people you get involved, then the broader your knowledge and the broader the experience, broader the perspectives you have to apply to something. And so that I think it's quite a harmful thing that trying to make it that it's the gift of the elite. But the way that I look at creativity is it's a bit like being an athlete. You know, we've all got the ability to take part in some form of sports. And that there's some people who are better built than others. So Usain Bolt has got a much better body structure than me for running. Mm. And that's genetic lottery that he won has made him a very good runner. But that would have meant nothing if he was a couch potato. It's to do with the effort that you put in. So it might be that some of our brains are slightly better wired for being able to come up with interesting ideas. But the thing that makes the difference is the effort. And what I look at with creativity is that you can't say that one person is creative and another person isn't creative. You can't say that one idea is creative and another idea isn't creative. It's not binary. It's a sliding scale. And you measure that sliding scale with obviousness. So an idea that's obvious has taken no effort to get to. So it's not really very creative. An idea that's non-obvious and it's valuable to us in however we measure value is what we call creative. So the more non-obvious it is and the more value it adds, then the more creative we consider it to be. So it's understanding, once you sort of realize it's a sliding scale, I think it makes it easier for people to jump on that ladder and go, at least I can be a little bit creative. And when you then understand that the way to become more creative is actually about how much mental effort you apply rather than how much natural ability you have, I think that helps people understand better how to get to the great ideas because it's all to do with how you use your brain.
Yeah, I really like that analogy. And the other thing you point out in the book quite a lot is that you know, creativity is about developing ideas to solve problems. And, you know, coming back to the discussion we're having right now about, you know, being creative and whether or not everybody has the ability to be creative, everybody has the ability to solve their own problems in some form or other. And as you say, you know, sometimes that might be a pretty obvious and pretty conventional solution to the problem. But a lot of the times you can actually observe people doing some really unique things. And, you know, there's a lot of times I make the observation where, gee, I wouldn't have thought of, you know, addressing that problem in that way, you know, just very simple things. So to me, that just suggests that everybody has the ability to be creative when they want to or need to.
Yes, I believe that everyone's got the ability. When it comes to the sort of creativity being about solving problems, that's kind of one branch of creativity. I think we have to split creativity into sort of creative doing and creative thinking. Creative doing is more the artistic stuff. It's about getting really, really good at something by putting in that mythical 10,000 hours, really, to become amazing at it. And when we look at artistic stuff like that, you're not necessarily solving a problem, but you're going out there to be different, to be non-obvious, to develop your own style. And then you've got creative thinking, which is what we then apply in business, which is all about being non-obvious to solve problems. So not all creativity is about problem solving. But the stuff that we're talking about in business and innovation very much is. But along with that, I think we need to embrace the idea of purposeless play as well. Because I think a lot of companies, they try very hard. They over-define the problem at the beginning. And by over-defining the problem, they kind of almost put the solution into the definition of the problem, which limits the thinking that you get. Yeah. And actually, a lot of great ideas come out of purposeless play. So it's actually about not having a necessary purpose for it, but you're messing around with stuff. And, you know, that's really where creativity came from in the ancient days when humans were evolving, was from purposeless play. And then it developed into products from there and developed into concepts.
Hmm.
And I don't think there's enough of that in business. I think we need more messing around, really.
Yeah. And you certainly talk about that in the section on corporate creativity or creativity in organizations. Now, one thing that you alluded to there, and I think this is key and it sort of comes up a lot in conversations I have on the podcast around innovation, and that's the curiosity as the foundation for creative thought. And, you know, you talked about play, and play is about sort of curiosity. And I think in the book you use the example of children. You know, they're experimenting all the time. And I was having a conversation with my business coach today around her grandchild, and she was showing me, you know, he was like, he's 14 months old, so he's sitting in his high chair and he's dropping stuff over the edge, and then he's looking over the edge. And I said, well, he's obviously testing out what's going on there. So, but at some point in time, that's kind of trained out of it, isn't it? Because we kind of, in that example, get told, you know, don't drop stuff on the floor.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. It's when I've got a 3.5-year-old, and so recently went through that phase again. Of course, when you've got a toddler, when they take a fork and they drop it on the floor, it's part of an experiment. And then you hand it back to them, and they drop it again, and the parent will get exasperated. Stop doing that! And actually, the child's going, hold on, does this effect replicate? Every time I do it, does this effect replicate? And they're getting to understand it. And it's part of the learning mechanism of a child to do that. And yeah, we get to this stage where we stop dropping forks on the floor. And we end up with just a head full of assumptions. And it's one of the biggest things that I do when I'm working with companies to help them understand the areas they can innovate within, is to work with them to list their assumptions. What are all your assumptions regarding this area that we're working on here? We list all the assumptions, and then we go, right, which ones are valid and which ones aren't? We shake the tree to see what falls off. And the amazing thing is, when you start to challenge those assumptions, every single time I do it, it's kind of these mind-blowing experiences for everyone, where they're going, oh my goodness, there are so many opportunities in here, because there's so many things we assume to be true that really either they're not true or they shouldn't be true. And we need to deal with them. And I, it's always a really interesting experience, this idea of assumptions and challenging them to get to opportunities.
And even identifying them, because I imagine that, you know, in many cases we have assumptions that we make that we're not even conscious we're making them.
Yeah, absolutely. The workplace is full of that.
Yeah. All right. So, and one of the things that it... Well, another theme that kind of pervades the book is you talk about learning by doing, and I guess the homework at the end of each chapter is part of that. But you also talk about the concept of starting small and working your way up. So rather than wait until you understand it all and can do the whole lot, start small, and the concept of every little success helps build that muscle.
Yeah, I mean, I used to get quite frustrated in the advertising industry that when you had a budget for a project, the way that the agencies like to work and the way that the clients like to work is you basically spent all of your development money coming up with an idea, creating the idea, and getting it ready for launch day. Then launch day happens, and there's no more money left, so you move on to a different project. And that always seemed like absolute nonsense to me, because every single time I put a digital campaign, which was just, I'm only saying digital because it was trackable, but any campaign out into the world, people never responded to it quite the way I thought they would. So if I created something that was an interactive piece of digital, they never did quite what I thought they would from it. And from that, I kind of learned that really what we should be doing is maybe putting a few small things out there, actually getting them out there with the budget that the client gives us, seeing what people respond to, and spending the rest of the money developing the thing that people are responding to. And then you can evolve it. So rather than spending everything up front, and it's the way that things are happening with innovation When I go into companies and I speak to them about innovation, I ask them what they're doing. And again, it's kind of like putting everything into the full budget into trying to do this one project, and then that expecting that one project to revolutionize your business. And it's just not the way it works. Innovation is something that's a constant process. It's something that should actually be embedded into the whole culture of the organization rather than being in the hands of a few specialists. And when you embed it into the organization, then you've got constant improvement and you're constantly getting better. You're not just trying to innovate for the big things, which is what innovation departments try to do. They try to get that we'll be the next Uber of banking or whatever.
When you've
got that within your organization as an attitude that we're coming up with ideas to make things better, you're constantly improving everything. And the whole company is moving forward with momentum. And that's how you properly do innovation. It's not these radical leaps to try to be disruptive. That's the stuff that I think is responsible for only 6% of CEOs being satisfied with their company's innovation. 6%! This came out in a McKinsey report last year.
Yeah.
So that means that 94% of company CEOs are not satisfied with their company's innovation, even when the same study showed that 84% of CEOs believe that it's really important to the future of their business. It's screwed up. Something has gone badly wrong.
Yeah, bit of a disconnect, isn't it?
Hugely.
I like how you pointed out that, you know, it needs to be part of the culture of the organization or part of the ongoing practice, and it's a constant thing. And I know you talked about the disruptors in there, and I've lived through this because I used to work for a big photographic company in the early days when I was there. Was when digital photography was born, and of course that was a big disruptor in the photography industry. But at the same time, you know, the reaction to okay, we've got to have our own disruptor or something is nonsense. But then the attitude that was there at the time was the other extreme, the conservative way, saying, "Well, the first prototype was absolute garbage," which it was. So it's never going to be any good, was the assumption and conclusion. You know, so film's always going to be better. So to me, that is kind of, you know, the culture of innovation is not there. It's kind of pretend it doesn't happen.
Yeah. I mean, in my early days, I was working in the music industry just as digital started to come in. So we started... I was working in a studio that we were working with reel-to-reel tapes, and we had racks of effects, and we had patch bays with cables all over the place. You know, it was mayhem, beautiful mayhem. And then we started to get computers coming in so that we could sequence our synthesizers, and then started to be able to record onto hard disk. And I went from this thing of you've got the limitation when you're working in analog and you've just got tape, and you've only got 16 tracks to work with, and you've only got a certain amount of effects you can use. You had those limitations, and those limitations are brilliant, because when I moved to hard disk recording, and I had my own recording studio in the early 2000s, and when I switched to hard disk recording, it was too liberating. You know, I could do anything. I could have as many effects running as I wanted. I could have as many channels as I wanted. I could patch things together in a way that I never could on tape. So to create these sort of Frankenstein guitar solos that are made up of 17 takes. You know, I could do all of that. And you know what? It didn't improve anything. In fact, it made it all harder. and there is this thing where we've got that new technology comes along, and that sometimes we look at it and go, isn't this wonderful? It's liberating. But actually, it can actually make things worse. and I wonder sometimes with photography, as somebody who's a keen photographer himself, and I operate cameras for film as well as photography, you know, I sometimes wonder that if it's better for me just to go back and get my old Russian Leicas out and run some film through them. There's benefits to both, but we have to understand how to use each of them in the best
absolutely. Way. Yeah. Yeah, I guess I was coming from the point of view, because I've still got my film camera as well. I've switched to digital, but I do still have a Nikon film camera, which I love, and you know, still occasionally do film. But from the point of view of what's happened in the industry, because, I mean, I think the film, film photographic industry is pretty well vanished. I mean, it's pretty hard these days to get a film developed anywhere.
Yeah.
Much less, you know, any specialist work, although, you know, enlargements and so on are still relying on film material. So it's still around. But I think the industry kind of didn't react to that disruption. So there was, to me, that kind of highlighted, you know, on the one hand, you have somebody's come in with a disruption, and then on the other hand is, you know, there's that dichotomy between can we do our own disruption, which is kind of not really the right response, or do we just ignore it?
So I think disruption has become quite a poisonous thing, and I think it comes from a misunderstanding. You know, it's Clayton Christensen in 97, his Innovator's Dilemma book, is the one who's really, he popularized the term disruption. It'd been around, but he popularized it. And I think the way he used it was all right. You know, he was saying that it was any technology that comes around and disrupts a marketplace. Do you know, the beautiful thing about how he used it is you're using it in the past tense. You're saying that disrupted a marketplace. Now, that's fine. That's fine saying that. You can say that a piece of technology did that. But, you know, none of these companies that we can say disrupted the marketplace ever set out to disrupt.
Yeah, that's right.
They set out to be excellent, and they got their timing absolutely right so that when the wave of change came, they were able to surf it. They were just at that point before mass adoption, and they create something that was so good that it tipped over the top of that moment so that it went to mass adoption. They were the ones riding high on it. It's all to do with timing and all to do with being excellent at what you're doing. The problem is that people have fallen for the myth of disruption. And I've been at these conferences, and I get so annoyed when I'm at innovation conferences. And as you can imagine, I get annoyed a lot because you get people on stage who are up there saying, you know, and you're just a bunch of banks, and why aren't you the Uber of banking right now? Why aren't you the Netflix of banking? And you have no idea what you're talking about, because that is just nonsense. You're telling people to aim to disrupt. Disruption is bad. Disruption means that you're asking people unlearn this and then relearn this. People aren't going to do that. That's hard work. It's expensive and it's hugely risky. And it just shows a fundamental misunderstanding of how innovation happens and how humans adopt technology and new ways of thinking. And I get massively frustrated by that because I think it's unrealistic. It may sound sexy, but it's absolute nonsense.
Yeah, and you're right that, you know, I mean, looking backwards, you can say that this was a disruptive technology, but that probably wasn't what they set out to do. And typically, the things that we understand as disruptive technology, I see it as in two areas. So there's either the new startup that presumably they've had some idea and they work to implement that idea in a marketplace that's ready for change, or it's an organization that has a lot of clout behind it. I mean, I'm thinking of the photography industry now with Sony starting up digital photography, an organization that has a lot of resources and money behind it that is expanding into a parallel market. So, you know, Sony were an electronics company. They weren't in photography much. And they decided that was a good fit for them. And how do we get into it? So they used their core strength, which was electronics, to get into photography.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think that's absolutely right. Yeah.
So in that sense, it's an innovation. It's not necessarily a disruptor, but it ended up disrupting that industry. So.
Yeah. And I think that there is this thing we're finding with big companies, because they've kind of fallen for this idea, this sort of sexy startup disruption approach. They don't understand where they are in the life cycle of their company. So, you know, every company when it starts out is massively open to ideas, because it depends on ideas. It's inventing who it is, what it offers, how it's going to invoice people, what its brand is, you know, where it's going to get offices. Everything is about decisions and about coming up with ideas. And then once they find their mojo, if they find their mojo, then they move on to the next stage, which is systemizing what they did, systemizing the magic so that they can replicate it again and again. At that point, they're less welcoming of ideas. All their creative focus is on building a system to be able to replicate what they were doing. And then the next stage beyond that, once they've replicated it, is about efficiency. It's about just improving it ever so slightly by making things cheaper, by getting staff to work harder, by creating ways of being able to replicate more predictably. And the companies are at this stage where they're all about efficiency. They're all about optimization. And they're wanting to act like a startup again.
Mm.
And these companies are going to Silicon Valley to look at the startups, and they go on these Silicon Valley safaris. It always just makes me laugh. It's ridiculous. They go on a Silicon Valley safari to meet all these startups, to go and have a look at Facebook, and they go, oh, wow, that's exciting. That's great. Take that back to the company. And to me, it's like a bunch of pensioners who've got bladder control issues going to a nursery and asking these three-year-olds who have not mastered bladder control themselves for any tips on how they can be better at holding on to their own wee. And it's absolute nonsense.
I wondered whether you'd bring the example out from the book.
Yeah.
But it's a very visual analogy, and I think it is quite telling.
Yeah, to me, it just smacks of desperation. Mm-hmm. And it smacks of people actually not understanding what innovation's about. They think it's about being young, cool, and sexy. And it's not. That's not what innovation is about. And that's why a lot of companies have missed the point. They bring in innovation specialists. They don't know what they're doing, the companies. So they just say, we'll trust you as an innovation specialist. They've not defined what their strategy is properly for innovation, because innovation needs to be tied to your business strategy. And these guys who are just told to be innovative, they just go for the cool and sexy stuff. And the stuff that's going to be big and make them look cool, that let them sort of fly to San Francisco a couple of times a year, and it's just you're then putting it in the hands of a few people who don't quite understand what the purpose is of their innovation within the role of the company itself, and I think that there's a lot of very, very dysfunctional innovation departments within businesses. So, and I'm sure there'll be some people listening to this right now going, shut up, stop talking. I like going to San Francisco. Don't say anymore.
Yeah. Well, having just come back from there, I can see why people like going there, but yeah.
That's lovely. I love going to Fisherman's Key, Fisherman's Wharf, and it's all good.
Yeah. So there's a couple of things, because we've talked a little bit about innovation. You have a pretty clear distinction in the book around innovation and creativity. And in creativity, you also distinguish between creative doing and creative thinking, which I think is very powerful in the structure, because I, as most of my listeners would know that listen regularly, I love frameworks, and you've got a really clear framework of developing creative thinking and you know, the difference between creative doing and creative thinking, and then the idea of innovation versus creativity, I think is really good. So explain those a little bit more for our listeners.
Yeah, I mean, certainly. I think with innovation and creativity, they both live within the realm of ideas. And ideas are the catalyst for change in any organization. So creativity is when we apply mental effort to be able to come up with stuff that's hopefully non-obvious. But innovation isn't necessarily about doing that. You know, innovation very often can be just about doing things that make the company better. It's more about doing than about the thinking, coming up with ideas. So if there's a system that's out there that's a better way of doing things, even if it's a financial management system within your company to sort out the invoicing, if you bring in a system from outside that's already been created, that actually is a form of innovation. You're improving the company a little by doing that. Now, it's when we're looking for creativity or originality, if we're looking for that. Originality is a very difficult term, but people use it a lot for creativity. You want to be original. We need to actually work out what level of originality we're looking for. So are we looking for something that's completely new to you? you know, that's the smallest form of originality. This is something that's new to me. Other people might have seen it, but it's new to me. Okay, that's the smallest form of originality. Or it could be something that's new to my peer group. Maybe everyone else knows it, but it's new to the group that I'm in, and that could be my company that I'm in. It could be new to the industry. So it might be an idea you take from another industry, and it's new to your industry. Or it can be new to the world. Now, about 3,000 years ago, there's a quote from the Bible that was said, and it said, "There is nothing new under the sun."
Yeah,
that was 3,000 years ago. So, how is it then that we think that we can come up with stuff that's new to the world? And it's this mythical idea of originality. And what we look at is that everything pretty much is a recombination of existing elements. So innovation very much is, it can be an existing element that's out there. It can be as much as taking the system that already exists and you're combining it with your company and the way you do things. That's a combination of elements. That is a creative act. So I'm kind of interested. To me, a lot of it really comes around that everything's within the realm of ideas, but creativity is more focused on coming up with ideas and innovation is more focused on doing ideas. I think the simplest way of saying it.
Yeah, that's. I was really intrigued by that distinction and also looking at, you know, your suggestions in terms of, you know, exercising your mind to think more creatively, and then you make the distinction between coming up with an idea and actually implementing the idea.
And yeah,
certainly had an interesting discussion with Sun on the podcast about, you know, how do you get buy-in for new ideas within an organization.
Yeah, now that's an interesting one. I think it's one of the places where innovation really struggles. Because innovation, if we're talking about something that's new to the company, for innovation, then anything that's new, once you get to this optimization stage of a company, anything that's new is toxic to the company. The company doesn't want new stuff once it's in an optimization stage of its life cycle. It's about eliminating the unpredictable. It's about eliminating risk. It's about eliminating anything that could shake the status quo.
Because that's disruptive within the company, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. And the company is focused on stasis and improvement rather than on change. And if your company is focused on that optimization and that sort of stasis, then it's always going to be really hard getting buy-in, because people's motivation is not to change. People might say they want innovation, but actually they want to want innovation. There's a difference. They'd like to like something new. There's a difference to liking something new and liking to like something new. You know, it sounds interesting, it sounds good, but actually the process, the road from here to making that new thing happen is a difficult one. And it's going to make people fear for their jobs, it's going to cause people extra work while it's bedding in. So people, there's always going to be protectioneering within a company. And a lot of that comes from the hierarchy of a company. And hierarchies, each layer you've got in a hierarchy is basically like putting it through a bunch of lawyers. Because the way that lawyers exist is that if you go to a lawyer with a contract and say, "What do you think of that contract?" And the lawyer just glances at it and goes, "Yeah, that looks all right." You're not going to feel as if the lawyer's done their job.
Yeah, yeah.
If you hand the contract to the lawyer, exactly, they're going to go, "The way that I measure my worth to you is to say that that clause isn't working there, and I think that we need to write something here. We want to protect ourselves here, and I think there's a risk here." They're going to point out problems. That's a lawyer's job. And every single level of a hierarchy operates like that, where the management level at that level believe that their job is to point out the problems so that they don't look like a fool when they present it to their manager. So what you're getting is you're getting a bunch of people who are only looking for problems. They're not looking for opportunities. So that means they're diminishing the idea as it goes through the system. And when you've got an organization that's like that, that's very hierarchy-based, if you're expecting an idea to travel through the hierarchy to the leadership at the top so that they can sign it off, it's dead. It's dead already. Don't even bother. Seriously. You've got a painful time there. It's not going to work. You need to bypass the hierarchy straight to the leadership. And the company should have a system to do that, to stop it going through these poisonous layers that kill ideas. And the best way is to actually turn the idea of the company in its head and understand that the management's job is to support the staff who are under them. And instead of looking for problems, to look for the opportunities in ideas and to help grow the opportunities. And it's turning the whole thing in its head. And it's very difficult to do with big organizations, but I found that you can do it within departments within an organization. And as long as that department itself has enough trust from the leadership, then there's a good chance that those ideas can happen. If they can go from that department directly to the leadership, it can work. So you can turn parts of the organization upside down and you'll get better ideas out of them and more chance of them actually happening, which is the important bit.
Yeah, one of the other things one of the other models you talked about is kind of a cross-functional team that brings together skills from all kinds of different areas. So the thinking is not focused on one particular area, which might stifle some ideas from outside that realm, and have them report to senior management level so that you bypass that filter that you've talked about.
Yeah, I mean, the most important thing with any system is that it has to bypass the hierarchical structure. It has to go directly to the leadership. I had somebody who was telling me they'd read the book, and last week they were telling me of a way that their organization works, which is that whatever level you're on, you present your idea to your manager, but your manager will give you feedback on it, but the feedback is actually designed to help you improve the idea, because it's then your responsibility, once you've presented it to them, is to then present it to their boss. So you're the one, the person who came up with the idea is the one who then presents it, laddering up the organization each time, taking the feedback and maybe making adjustments or maybe fighting back to say, no, I don't think that works. So the one person who came up with the idea, it's their responsibility to go layer by layer by layer until they reach the top. And he's saying that that's really working for his organization. That one's not in the book, it's one that I'm quite interested in. I can see it's totally dependent on the attitude of the organization and how you manage that, because there is potential if you just try and implement that system without putting in the thought to it, there's potential that you will still kill the ideas.
Yeah, it sounds good in theory, but I'm just wondering, particularly if it's somebody at the coalface who, depending on how they feel rewarded for coming up with new ideas, they've got to then jump through all these hoops until it's presented to somebody that will then make a decision on whether to go forward with developing that or not.
Yeah, I mean, one of the problems I can see with that as well is this jumping through hoops, what it does is it kills momentum. And I think it's really important when you've got a project is to keep momentum up, to try and get to prototype as quickly as possible. However good that prototype is, whether it's a paper prototype, whether it's a physical prototype or a digital prototype, you should be getting to something that feels real as quickly as possible. And the problem is that when you're doing all this hoop jumping, it's very, very easy to kill people's passion, so that by the time they're three layers in, they're going, stuff this. I can't be bothered doing this anymore. This is eating my soul.
Yeah, that's the risk I see in that. But, look, coming back to, I guess, individuals and people that are wondering, well, how do I improve my creativity, or I'm not creative, how do I become creative? You talk quite a bit in the book about developing the skills and building on everybody's skills in creativity. So talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, people see creativity as one thing. It's like you are creative or you're not. You know, it's like, oh, you can dance. It's that kind of thing. And creativity is actually a whole bunch of skills, in the same way as actually dancing is a whole bunch of skills. Yeah. And we need to break it down into those skills and understand what skills we need to be able to see something through. So, I think anyone can come up with ideas. I truly believe that. Anyone can come up with ideas. But fewer people know how to judge a good idea. Fewer people know how to develop an idea to make it as good as it can be. Fewer people know how to communicate that idea to others. Fewer people know how to get a team behind you to fill in the gaps that you don't have. And very, very few people, the rarest skill of all is tenacity, to actually see something through to completion. And it's one of these things I realize looking back now is that I unconsciously, when I was creative director of ad agencies, I used to hire for tenacity. So people would come to me with their portfolios and I'd look through their portfolio and, you know, if they had a good portfolio, that was great. They were, as far as I was concerned, they're past the first stage. The next stage was, right, what do you do outside work? What are your passions? What are you interested in? And I was looking for people who had passion projects because I was looking for people who were completers, people who knew how to finish things, people who knew how to make things happen. So I hired graffiti artists and cake decorators, people who'd started up their own t-shirt shops, you know, people with Etsy stores, because these people, they were completers, they were doing something. And if I have those people in my department, it means that I can trust them to actually make things happen. It means that I don't have to try and push them and drive them to make something happen that's not going to be great. It means I've got people that know what it's like to take things through to completion. And it's a really important skill, tenacity. And so the first part is you have to hire for it. And the second part is your organization needs to be there to support it. Because if you've got loads of tenacity, but you keep giving people those hoops to jump through, those hurdles to jump over, you're going to sap their energy no matter how tenacious they are. And that's a lot of the problem of why ideas don't make it through to completion. They don't actually make it to market, is because the system is just so, it's such a slog to get through that people just don't keep their energy up and the ideas just get crushed along the way. So this idea of skills, I think, is understanding that there's multiple skills to have. As well, I think understanding the way that our brains work, if we want to get better at coming up with ideas, the way that most people think that it works is you need to have great brainstorm techniques. You need to have great things that you can, I mean, we've got this wonderful technique, we'll just get a bunch of people in a room and we've got this wonderful technique and the ideas will fall out. And it's really misguided. The brain is a processor, and it's not a computer, but it's a processor. And we've got input, process, output. And if you've got a whole bunch of rubbish in your head or stuff that everyone else has in their heads, it's of no value to you. Because no matter how you process it, the computer programming industry says garbage in, garbage out. Yeah, yeah. You know, if you've got a narrow hopper of input in your brain, no matter how you process it, you're going to have a narrow ability to come up with ideas. However, if you spot things that no one else spots, then you can come up with ideas that no one else can come up with. So it's all about filling your head with non-obvious stuff, with a breadth of stuff, with interesting stuff. Because if you have a crappy data set and you put it through a Cray supercomputer, you're going to get crappy results. If you've got a really good data set and you put it through a Raspberry Pi, you'll get great results. It'll just take longer. So the processing is secondary to the input. And if we want to get good at coming up with ideas, the most important thing is to feed our minds, and to feed our minds with a breadth of stuff and non-obvious stuff. And that's the stuff that will make us much better at coming up with ideas.
Yeah, great advice. And this is really fascinating. I could probably go on and talk for hours, but I think we'll leave our audience to go and read the book and find out some more, and we'll talk a little bit about how you can get a hold of the book shortly. But I think it's time to move on to the buzz, which is our innovation round. Now, it's a series of five questions that hopefully will help our audience who, you know, they're leaders in their field and they like to think of themselves as innovators. So hopefully we can get some tips from your experience. And we probably covered all of these five. So it's really, I guess I'll ask you to encapsulate your thoughts and summarize a little bit. So the first question is, what's the number one thing anyone needs to do to be more innovative?
Yeah, I mean, this is the whole thing is innovative rather than creative. So if it was creative, I would say feed your mind to come up with ideas. But it's about being innovative. And to be innovative, I think you need to be tenacious. I think it's resilience and tenacity are really the most important things. And I think to get good at that, start off small. Give yourself a project that you can do in an evening. And then do another project you can do in an evening. Start to work your way up to something that you do over a weekend. And you get a buzz from completing things. And you start to learn how to deal with obstacles. And you work your way up until you can take on projects for a company that are sort of big, long projects. But it's that resiliency, because I think there's one way you can do it. There's the project management way, which is being very, very rational about it, just to get it through from here to the end. But I think the most important thing along that journey is actually to have the passion. Because when you've got a passion, you're going to defend the stuff that makes it good. And you're going to stop the stuff that's going to weaken it. You're going to get a team that are excited, that are going to put in extra effort, because passion is contagious. And you will get something that's so much better at the end. So project management's important, but you need to have passion throughout the project. So I'd say that kind of tenacity to me has passion within it.
Yeah.
It's not just about trying to get from there to the end, trudging. It's got passion within it. So tenacity to me is the most important thing for innovation.
Mm. Great advice. And I love that. And I love the example you gave in the book about the pizza slices, because I'm reminded when my kids were young, they learned piano and they used to memorize these, you know, 30, 45-minute piano concertos together with all the orchestral accompaniment and stuff. And I always wondered how that was done, how the mind actually managed to do that, particularly a sort of an 8 or 10-year-old kid. And the piano teacher would always say, and especially when there were difficulties, she'd always say, treat it like pizza, one piece at a time, one slice at a time. And I think you talk about the pizza in that chapter. Yeah. All right. So what's the best thing you've done to develop new ideas?
I think to develop new ideas, to me, it's about the process. So when I work with companies, I like to get a process that's going to work. And part of that is about getting the senior leadership team involved at the right time. You know, very often what happens is they come in at the end of a project because they're always so busy. They come in at the end of the project and then they make their comments at the time where their comments are most damaging and most costly. And what I like to do is create a process where we get the people who are interested, the stakeholders involved at the very beginning. And at that point, we define what their hopes are. We kind of create the KPIs, I guess, for the project. Although I've kind of got a little bit of an allergy to these business three-letter acronyms. But, you know, we create that sort of list of what it is that will make the project a success to them. And then we assign one person. And that one person who's assigned to the team, as then they're leading the team and they've got the right of veto over any feedback that comes. So they can actually disagree with feedback that comes in. They're the person who holds the vision, and it needs to be one person, because the more people you have, the more it just turns into bland soup. And it's really important, if an idea is to be intact, it needs to have vision. So one person who gets involved there, but other people, you're kind of reporting to the leadership team throughout. So there's clarity. So they can see, there's transparency to it. And then we make sure that the process is a really short journey, as short as possible, with as few status meetings as possible, to go from the beginning to the prototype. So to me, the process is absolutely vital. And most processes that I've seen in companies when it comes to innovation is the process that kills the idea. So I try to create the process that enables it instead.
Mm. Yeah, I love that. It's, you know, you describe a situation there that I've lived through a few times in my corporate career where, you know, the leaders come in at the end and, oh, is that what you've been doing? And then, yeah, the criticism comes in and all the hard work is kind of destroyed in one yep. short meeting.
Yeah.
Very efficient. All right. So do you have a favorite tool or system for improving your own productivity and allowing you to be more innovative?
I kind of, when it comes to sort of working with teams of people, I guess is the, to be more innovative, I love this assumptions thing that I talked about, of listing assumptions and then tackling them, because it just opens up so much, so many opportunities. But for myself, I guess the My system is just to feed my mind as much as possible. And I like to give myself space as well to think about things. I don't think people give themselves very much space. I think it's all about doing, doing, doing. I think that the focus on productivity in business for the last few years has actually become poisonous again. I think when I left the advertising industry nearly 10 years ago, it got to a level that was dysfunctional. I was told that I was supposed to be at least 93% productive. You know, that was my utilization rate had to be above 93%. It's like, are you serious? Because actually a lot of what I need to do is actually mess around, experiment with things, fill my mind with stuff. That's the stuff that makes me really good at my job. If you're focused on the output and you've not got enough time for input, you're going to run dry. And I've got to say that that's probably why most advertising is absolute crap, because the industry is focused on productivity rather than actually allowing people who are supposed to be coming up with the ideas the time to feed their brain and to experiment and try stuff out. So to me, I do a lot of playing. When I come up with an idea for a website, I will just go and do it. I'll just buy the domain. I'll build the site myself. I'll build a digital tool myself, because I'm kind of fortunate that I can code. So to me, there's a lot of play in what I do, a lot of experimentation in what I do. And a lot of that leads to stuff that I can then use, that I can then take that thinking into a workplace when I'm consulting, or it can go into some of my films or my books or speeches or whatever I do. So it's actually to give yourself enough space rather than try to be focused on being productive as an output.
Yeah. And you talk quite a bit in the book about, you know, giving yourself time and space to think, imagine, let your mind wander or not focus on the day-to-day stuff. And, you know,
yeah,
93%, whatever it is.
Yeah, there's this wonderful thing they discovered. I mean, it's only in the last 20 years or so that they've come around with this theory of the brain. It used to be that we thought that there's little pockets of our brain and they each did different things. And we thought that it was all about being focused. You want to be focused on a task. And back in the 1920s, the guy who created the EEG that goes on the skull cap that goes in your head to measure brain activity, he noticed in the 1920s that when somebody was focusing on a task, he was able to measure the amount of electricity the brain was using. And when then the person slacked off from the task and wasn't doing anything, their brain used the same amount of electricity. And he wrote studies on this, and the psychological community just went, your machine must be broken. What nonsense. And then sort of studies came out in the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s that really showed the same thing. Like, you know, looking then at the chemical side and seeing that the calorific intake of the brain was the same when you were relaxing as it was when you were focused. And in the early 2000s, really, they came up with a theory of what we call the default mode network. It was actually the fact that the brain goes into network states. Rather than it being about individual pockets being activated. So when we focus, it's kind of the front part of our brain shuts off all the extraneous noise. Mm. And I mean, very often when you find that you're focused, you don't even really hear things very much. Yeah. You don't spot stuff happening about you. We're very good. Our brain's very good at that. And we think that that's a great thing. But actually, when you slack off and you go into a daydreamy state, you activate what we call the default mode network. And this is when we start to envision things. You know, this is when you start having those conversations in your heads where you replay a conversation you've had with someone and you go, oh man, I wish I'd said that. Drat. You know, all that kind of stuff. Or you start thinking, now what would happen if this happened? You know, you start fantasizing about the future as well. So you replay the past. You kind of like recreate the past in a way that you think it would have been better. You imagine a future and you get into this lovely state where it's all about what ifs and possibilities. And this is all about the feet up on the desk, staring into space moments. Now, if you're wanting people to come up with ideas in an office, they're not going to feel free to get into that state, because that state is kind of like a drifty, dreamy state.
Yeah.
They don't want to be at their desk looking as if they're kind of, they've just had five spliffs. You know, you don't want people like that in the office. People don't want other people to be looking at them when they're in that drifty state in an office. So it means that people aren't going into that really valuable state because people feel that they have to be present at their desk. And I love just the idea, the way the brain works, that there's focus, and then the opposite of focus is the default mode network, where we go into this daydreamy state, and actually that's really where the best ideas come from.
Yeah.
From drifting off.
And I had an interesting conversation on the podcast a little while ago with Dr. Fiona Kerr, who's a neuroscientist, and she was very strong on the idea of daydreaming and, you know, allowing the brain space to daydream, to come up with new ideas for the very same reason.
Yeah.
Okay, what's the best way to keep a project or a client on track?
I think it's about trust. And I think a lot of the way that things work in creative industries and in the innovation world is they try to have this black box mentality of, you know, just leave us to it. We'll come back to you when it's done. No, don't disturb us. That kind of approach. And that just makes people nervous. And I think that it's, if you're wanting to build trust and you're wanting to get people on side, I think there needs to be a certain amount of clarity. You make the process itself, at least the process, make that clear as to what's happening. If you're still needing more time to think about it, make that clear that that's what you're doing. And I think at the beginning of a project, as I said, but getting the leadership involved so you can set out your goals and your assumptions, your KPIs, all that stuff at the beginning, I think is really important. And then you refer to that throughout the process to check that you're on track. And then you use it to judge the work at the end. So it then, by sorting out how you're judging it at the beginning, it makes it easier to judge it at the end. And I think that that's something that a lot of people in the creative industries and in innovation forget about, that you should be sorting out your judgment at the beginning. Judgment isn't just something that happens once you're finished. So I'd say that kind of building up trust and having clarity is the best way to do that, I would say.
Yeah, great points. And, you know, having something to measure against and making sure that's clear from the outset is really great advice. And I think something that a lot of people kind of do on the fly as they progress through a project rather than at the beginning.
Yeah, they try and post-rationalize it at the end. Yeah. And I don't think that's the best way.
All right. Now, here's one you do talk a little bit about in the book, in terms of having ideas that are different to others or that are unique, because that's one of the kind of differentiators. So what is the number one thing anyone can do to differentiate themselves?
I mean, it's really in the word, isn't it? It's be different. You know, it's be different to everyone else. There's in the, having come from sort of marketing and advertising, and the way that I look at innovation is I look at innovation as a brand building thing, as you'll have seen from Iconic Advantage with Soon, that you want to differentiate yourself, you want to be different, and you can't stand out by blending in. But so why is it then that most cars on the road look pretty much the same? Why is it that when you walk down the supermarket aisle that most of the shampoo bottles pretty much look the same? Why is it that that happens? Why do we end up with this homogeneity? Why is it that most ads on television kind of look the same? And it seems as if, you know, we know that differentiate means be different. Yet we're living in a world of complete homogeneity, which means that the bar is really low for people to stand out because everyone else is being the same. And if you think of the greatest artists of our times, the ones that we've remembered, you know, if you look at Picasso kind of reacted against realism and created this sort of wonderful style that was a reaction to realism. And then you look at Warhol, and Warhol reacted against painterliness by using mass production techniques rather than sort of fine art finesse. When you look at Banksy's reacting against the art world as being a commercialized industry where ridiculous value is added to things, and he wants to create things that actually rot and are relatively disposable. So the
get shredded when they get shredded as soon as the hammer falls on the sale.
Exactly. So Reacting is one of the best ways to get noticed. These are the artists we remember, are the ones who reacted. We don't remember the people who were being painterly and being realists and who were into this sort of high value stuff. We don't remember them as well as we remember the people who bucked the trend, reacted against it. So it's actually, I tend not to try and encourage people just to react against stuff, but you know, it's actually a good place to start.
Yeah.
It's just stop doing it the way you're doing it. Do something different. And that's how you're going to stand out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think there's probably things that annoy annoy most people, right? And so if you kind of look at that and say, well, what can I do to make that better or make it different is maybe the first reaction you can have then.
Absolutely. It's see the stuff that frustrates you. That's always a great place to start. What's really, really peeing you off right now? What's frustrating you? What's irritating you? And do something about it.
Yeah.
And you know, there's these people that you find down the pub, the ones who say, and that something happens, you go, oh, I thought of that years ago. You know, those guys. That actually, it'd be great if those guys could actually harness the stuff that annoys them and actually make their ideas happen rather than just go, oh, I thought of that. Because I actually quite genuinely think that they did think of that. It's just they didn't do something with it. And I just try to encourage people to actually do stuff with the things that irritate them.
Yeah, great advice. And yeah. All right. Well, we talked a little bit about this before we started the interview. So what's the future for you and your business?
Well, whatever it is, it's going to be interesting. I guess my life's it's all about a journey rather than a destination. So, you know, a lot of people, it's the idea of a career, I guess, is that you find something you enjoy and then you'll kind of do that until you retire. That's kind of been, that was certainly the dream of my parents' generation. And I'm doing something new all the time. And it's not just sort of year on year I'm doing something new, which I most definitely am, but it's day to day and even hour to hour. So yesterday I was, what was I doing yesterday? I wrote an article yesterday. I did illustrations. I did a little bit of video editing. Today I am editing a documentary script that we're about to start filming. You know, so I'm doing something different all the time. But to me, I know that I need to have a look at my business because at the moment I am just one guy. And I earn money from my time and what I put into stuff. And I don't earn money from writing books. Very few people do earn money from writing books. I don't really earn much money from doing film. But what these things give me is they give me profile. And profile means that the more people that know about me, then the more people can hire me. And I guess the more my profile is, I suppose I can start to increase my rate according to my profile. So for me, the next stage is to try and create something that would be the foundation of my business. It would be the residual income part. And that is doing online courses, which means that there can be something up there online all the time that people are able to learn whenever they want. And that would be something that I would hope would be the foundation of my business. And that's something that I'm working on at the moment. And I know that you're looking at as well. Because when I've been running courses for years and I've got lots of IP there, it would be beneficial to me to share that stuff with more people, and to be able also in return be able to get income from that too. So that's the future of my business at the moment. But everything to me is an experiment, and it's all moving on. And if something doesn't work, I pivot. And that's really been what I've been doing a lot for years because I've got a very short attention span.
All right. Well, we look forward to keeping track of where that heads with the online courses and all the other activities. So what's the number one piece of advice you'd give to any business owner who wants to be a leader in innovation?
Innovation's an attitude rather than a department.
I love that. Yeah.
Yeah, but I think if you embed it into your whole company, then you're more likely to be a winner. I think ghettoizing innovation, I think, is a real mistake, and it's where most industry is at the moment.
Hmm. All right, that's fabulous. This has been really great, Dave. I've really enjoyed this. Now, where can people reach out to you and say thank you, and where can people get a hold of the book?
I'm ridiculously Googleable. There are four Dave Burses in the world, it seems, and a few years ago we all got in touch with each other. But it's the problem comes from the spelling of my surname, because if you spell it wrong, you get the Jewish term for circumcision, and I don't recommend that you Google that in a work computer. It's just, you just Google me, Dave, and then my surname is Burse, B-I-R-S-S. And if you go to daveburse.com, you'll find me. If you go to Twitter, there's Dave Burse. You'll find me talking about inane nonsense there. I'm all over the social networks, but I'm very Googleable. So if you just Google me, you'll find out lots of stuff that I've been doing.
All right. And if you go to daveburse.com/great ideas, that's where there's information on the book and how to order it. And also it is, or it will shortly be available. I think it's available for pre-ordering on Amazon.
Yeah, it's available for pre-order just now. Yeah. Mm.
So it will shortly be available, I think 8th of November, right?
Yes, that's right. And it managed to, during pre-orders, we managed to get it to number one in about half a dozen categories, including philosophy. That really made my day, knowing that I was the best-selling textbook on philosophy in the world.
Interesting. So, a philosophical side to innovation. Yeah. All right. Well, finally, who would you like me to interview on a future InnovaBuzz podcast, and why?
Well, I have to think about this. There's a guy that I think is really interesting around the field of AI, and you know, he actually doesn't. He's considered to be an AI thinker and doer and writer, but he doesn't really even believe that artificial intelligence exists. And he's a really interesting guy because of that. You know, he questions the whole thing while he's actually doing it. And his name's Pete Trainer. And I would recommend that you get Pete on the podcast. And I know that recently you had Carla Johnson on.
Yes, we did.
And Carla was speaking with me and Pete at an event 2 weeks ago in the south of France. So we all know each other. Yeah, I would say Pete. He's got some really interesting points of view. He's wonderfully creative, incredible with technology, but a real visionary thinker. I think he'd be wonderful.
Sounds fascinating. So, Pete, if you're listening to this, keep an eye on your inbox for an invitation from us to the InnovaBuzz podcast, courtesy of Dave Burris. So we might get an introduction from you.
I'll sort that out immediately.
All right. Well, thanks. Thanks so much for sharing your time and your insights with us today so generously. I've really enjoyed this, and thanks for sending a pre-production copy of the book. I've really enjoyed reading that, and I'll probably buy a hard copy and take to it with a highlighter next time around. I've really enjoyed this and the book, and I wish you all the best for the future, and let's keep in touch.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Jürgen. That was great.
Thanks. I hope you enjoyed that thoroughly fascinating conversation with Dave, and as I did, noted some ideas from his recommendations. I was particularly delighted by Dave's ability to break down the complex subject of creativity and ideas into practical frameworks and steps we can all take to be more creative and come up with more ideas. I'd love to know what you took away from Dave's interview. Leave a comment below the blog post, which can be found at innovabiz.co/Dave Burris. That is DaveBirss. All lowercase, all one word, innovabiz.co/Dave Burris.
You'll also find contact information for getting in touch with Dave there, as well as links to all the resources we mentioned, including his new book, How to Get Great Ideas, that should be published by the time we publish this podcast episode. Dave suggested I interview Pete Trainer, a pioneer in the area of AI-focused services, and also author of a recently published book, Hippo, Human-Focused Digital, on a future in NovaBuzz podcast. That sounds absolutely fascinating and a very topical subject. So Pete, keep an eye on your inbox for an invitation from us to the InnovaBuzz podcast, courtesy of Dave Bierce. Remember to visit innovabiz.co/VIP to access the Transformational Marketing Hub and all its free and exceptionally useful information to help you transform your marketing. Stay connected. Head on over to iTunes or Stitcher or Pocket Casts and subscribe to the InnovaBuzz podcast so you make sure you'll never miss another episode. We'd also love you to leave us a review because what you think matters. Take some of the ideas you've heard today and apply them in your business. Any thoughts, ideas, suggestions, or questions, share them in the comments below the blog post. And remember, if you want to get better marketing results than you ever have, join our fantastic LinkedIn community at the Transformational Marketing Academy. All you have to do is go to innovabiz.co/TMAC. It's free to join. Hope to see you there soon. Until next time, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Remember to be awesome and keep innovating.